When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hello, and welcome back to We're Not So Different, a podcast that I'm recording at 7 a.m. local time.
F's in the chat.
And boy, can you absolutely tell I look like warmed over dog shit. My name is Luke. I am an amateur historian. And as always, I'm joined by Dr. Eleanor Yanega, who is anything but.
It's noon here. Today. I'm fine.
Not me. They call me Mr. Worldwide though, because that's my, that's a good joke. But first, we have a question from one of our patrons, Charlotte, who says, you sort of started addressing this while talking about the origins of nationalism, but what was the vibe among people about wars going on, i.e. if a random peasant not near the actual England versus France or miscellaneous King I versus miscellaneous King II conflict? Am I emotionally invested in who wins in the same way modern folks are in their country being victorious? Does it impact my relationship with the people I may live under the miscellaneous king?
This is a great question, Charlotte. And the answer is, it all depends. But it specifically depends in such a way where it's like, well, it's one thing, you know, like, is your farm not going to be pillaged, right? So it's like automatically your interest wanes. But the next thing is like, well, is anyone you know, have they been drafted in? So if anyone you know has been drafted in, that is going to change your mind about this a bit. And now, I know this, again, from, you know, I'm constantly talking about, sorry I read so many sermons, guys. It's like...
I'm tired of your sermonizing.
I know, right? Like, but it's Thomas Brinton, you know, I was talking about him on the Patreon last week, so he's the one who wrote all these sermons that were like, well, he's one of the ones who wrote all these sermons about how the plague was because you're dressing too slutty. But in his plague sermons, he also talks about the Hundred Years' War. And how England isn't doing particularly well, and he at the time, and he interprets this also as like God's judgment about the fact that you're dressing too slutty. Now, he was down in Rochester, which is like one of the Medway cities. Sorry, on the River Medway, and it's in Kent. And so probably the reason he's bringing it up is that in Kent you have the Kentish bowmen. And so, like, Kent is known as a place with, like, a lot of people who are good at long bow. And so they draw really heavily from that for times of war. So he is probably bringing this up because people in Rochester probably know somebody, right, who's in France fighting at the moment. And so as a result, that's kind of like news that they would be interested in. Now, if you go to Northumbria and say that, people are going to be like, cool, you know, because like, like, who care? You know, in Northumbria, their concerns are probably going to have more to do with Scotland and fighting that goes like back and forth across there. And they're going to be like less interested in, you know, fighting France because like France as an idea is a much further away place. And this is something that you do see people complain about the wars being just kind of pointless one way or another anyway. And like that's very much a thing that kind of runs through as a vein for ordinary type folks. So like, for example, a lot of the time we see complaints about taxation for wars or complaints about how everyone came and got scooped up and taken off somewhere stupid. But you tend to see more complaining about rich people's wars than you see, oh, yeah, like I don't like French people. Although you do see some I don't like French people, but like that tends to again be like more from southerners, less from northerners in England.
I don't like those French people, even though we speak French here. Yeah, exactly. English court. And also
maybe they mean that they don't like, yeah, they're like, I don't like the royals. That's what that means. You know, like less I don't like French people, more like I don't like rich people.
I mean, I realize it comes from a lot of things later, especially like the Hundred Years' War. But you know, the like English French rivalry has always been funny to me. Like,
yeah,
motherfucker,
yeah.
Y'all were the same for well, a bit there.
It's really interesting too, because when we look at for example, poor people in places like Paris, we have big. Like, especially in the 14th century, kind of like later 14th, 15th century, there's a really great book about this. I think it's called The Urban Poor in the Middle Ages. I can't remember exactly. But a lot of women who live in Paris are actually English. And, you can just be like, all right, well, I'm off to like Bright Lights Big City, right? Like the biggest place you can go is Paris. And you know, you end up being a washerwoman there and it kind of sucks, but like lots and lots of English people end up over there because they all speak French. So it's much more porous than you would think as well. It's not just kind of like, you know, when no one's going to check your passport, you could just do that if you feel like it. So there is kind of a lot of toing and froing, and that also gives you this kind of idea that, again, we're kind of talking 14th, 15th century. So like this whole Hundred Years' War business and stuff for the average person is like, if they're not burning down your farm, like who cares, you know, because fundamentally it's not actually going to change anything for you, especially if you're English. Like there's no difference between like this group of French speakers or that group of French speakers ruling you, right? So if you've got like a person who got drafted into the war, you're going to be more interested in it otherwise, but as a whole, I mean, not really is the answer, you know. Which is, you know, part of like what's pernicious about nationalism as a concept generally.
It makes you really want Calais back for some reason.
Yeah, exactly, right? Stuff like that. Like it's for when you have like British disease, like, you know, when you, which is to say bovine spongiform encephalitis, you know, like suddenly you're out here thinking that we need to own Gibraltar. I don't know, it's very confusing to me too, but there it is. Sorry, everybody. It's gonna be I'm deep in day two of the Platinum Jubilee weekend, and there's gonna be a lot of me grumbling about the monarchy. Is what's up. So that's just what's happening this week.
Yeah. So yeah, it seems like people didn't really care unless they had a personal investment with it, and part of that's probably because of the lack of the rise of nationalism. At that point, nationalism as we understand it now. At that point,
And it's like, you know, you have a thing going back and forth. Like, I mean, there's casual xenophobia. But like xenophobia and nationalism are not the same thing, right?
They're like, I hate the French, and you're like, well, I mean, you know, now if you say I hate the French, that just means something a bit different than it did then, probably. You know, you're just you're not complaining about Charlemagne now. Well, I mean, you might be, but whatever.
We could start, I guess.
Yeah. Just turn this into a Hold Steady song. Complain about a guy named Charlemagne the whole time. Anyway, Charlotte, thank you so much for your question for the Patreon. If you would like to ask us questions like this on the show, you can for just $5 a month at patreon.com/WNSDpod. And as an update, in June, we're starting our first book club series exclusively for patrons. And we will be discussing J.R.R. Tolkien's famous and infamous lore dump, which is the Silmarillion. We're going to talk about the meta side of things and how Christopher Tolkien compiled it after his father's death. We'll talk about the characters who are still present during Lord of the Rings. And, of course, Tolkien's many, many medieval influences. I mean, also, it's got the biggest dragon in the history of fiction, and you cannot go wrong with that. Mm-hmm. So subscribe to the Patreon, because that's coming soon. And, yeah, we think you probably would enjoy that. Yeah,
yeah, so, absolutely. Speaking of Patreons, too, I just want to do a quick shout-out to patron Desiree, who's going through it. She's lost her dog, Violet. R.I.P. Violet, the show wants to say.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it
sucks. To hear that, that's no good.
It sucks a lot, you know. And but, you know, one of the things that I think is nice about the Patreon and stuff like that is that we can communicate with you guys more better. So, you know, Desiree going through it, and we just want to say hello to her and, you know, try to cheer people up about things. Yeah. So, you know, we'll give you pep talks too.
Definitely.
Just sorry to hear that, man. It's a bummer. It's a bummer.
Yeah. It's no good. No. It's no good. Sorry to hear that. But, thank you so much to everyone who's subscribed, and, on to the main show this week, which is about medieval hospitality. And this came up because, you guessed it, a meme was making the rounds this past weekend and past week. You might have seen it, but if not, I'm going to describe it here, since, as we all know, podcasts are a visual medium. It's a color-coded picture of Europe entitled, "Will You Receive Food as a Guest at Someone's House?" Nations in dark blue are almost always, and these include the Iberian Peninsula, Italy, Greece, Southern Europe, and Turkey. Nations in light blue are usually yes, and these include Ireland, Scotland, Northeast Spain, Southern and Central France, Northern Italy, Poland, Ukraine, Romania, Hungary, Russia, and basically every other European nation that's not mentioned otherwise here. Nations in pink are unlikely to give you food, and this includes Northeast France, England and Wales, Southern and Central Germany, Belgium, Switzerland, the Southern Netherlands, and Austria. And finally, nations in red are very unlikely to give you food and include all of Scandinavia, Denmark, Northern Germany, Northern Netherlands, and Iceland, which on this map has been pushed far to the southeast and now sits off the coast of France and Spain. So it's no longer icy there. I'm sure it's probably nice. And people are like, yeah, I'm going to give more people food now because it's not fucking 50 below. Because now we have these nice compared to what it was, we have these tropical winters now here in France, Spain, Iceland. If you weren't able to follow along with all that, don't worry. We've included a pic in the show notes and in the tweets about the show on our Twitter account. But the basic gist is that you're more likely to be force-fed food if you visit someone in a southern European country, and to be forced to hungrily watch as your host finish their five-course dinner in front of you in Scandinavia. Of course, the map spawned all sorts of discourse, everything from more memes and jokes to explanations to insane threads about why certain Europeans are more hospitable than others that are at most two steps removed from phrenology. But since this became so popular, we decided to talk about medieval customs surrounding hospitality, guest rights, and what a person could expect when they entered a home or business of one another. Would the medieval European get salt, bread, shelter, and safety when entering the home of another, or would they receive the metaphorical cold shoulder while some Finns ate their dinner in front of you? Let's find out. Eleanor, before we talk specifically about hospitality, initial thoughts on this map that's definitely completely scientific.
We
need to be clear here that scientific rigor has been met in the making of this map that randomly showed up on Twitter.
It's like, it drives me crazy, right? Because, you know, like, as a social historian, this is in some ways my bread and butter, is thinking about, you know, what societies do and how they react And, you know, and also, like, just gauging the temperature on the world's worst, you know, social media platform and, like, getting some information from people there is, like, probably not rigorous. I'm just saying. But it's really interesting because I asked, I was talking to one of my very tight friends, the good Dr. Sara Obeg-Stradal, who, as the name indicates, is Swedish. And I was all like, the fuck is going on out here? Is this true? You know? And she was like, I mean, not really. And her thing was about the children being over and maybe you don't get fed is that, well, it can happen, but why it usually happens is because there's a Scandinavian assumption that you will be eating with your family because eating with your family is like the most important thing you do every day.
Hmm. Interesting.
So, like, you would need to kind of check, like, parents would need to cross-check, mm-hmm. like, who is eating where. And if that hasn't been done, the assumption is you're going to eat with them. And she was like, the thing that's weird about it is, like, ordinarily you would then, like, go home. Like, if that was happening.
Yeah.
And, like, obviously if it was a sleepover or something like that, you would be fed. But she lived very near to her best friend growing up, and they would kind of, like, eat interchangeably at each other's houses. But there, mm. when that happened, you had to, like, call your parents and say, like, I'm gonna eat here, and like, this sort of thing.
Yeah.
There's also an ongoing thing here, which is quite interesting, which is defining, like, how do you feed people?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
yeah. Because, you know, like, Scandinavians, like, I mean, I don't know if you guys had to, like, put up with this, but there was this whole obsession here, at least, in the UK for a while with, like, so there's a Danish word called hygge, or hygge, which means, like, coziness. And there's this, like, thing where it's, like, if you have people around, you will, like, immediately kind of, like, give them a cup of coffee and light a candle.
Yeah.
Like, you know, where you're just kind of, like, trying to make things nice.
Yeah.
It's spelled H-Y-G-G-E, but I don't speak anything Scandinavian, so I don't know how you fucking say that. Mm-hmm. But within that, you know, like, yeah, Swedes and stuff are going to give you a cup of coffee and, like, some cookies or something, like some biscuits. Mm-hmm. But, like, they're, like, whether or not you're going to have a meal, that's, like, a bigger thing. And, I mean, yeah. It's certainly true here as well, because it's interesting, like, you know, with Britain on that map being, you know, like, oh, we're probably not going to get food. The first thing that's going to happen, though, is that people are going to put the kettle on. And, like, that's not a joke.
Yeah.
Like, the number one thing that's going to happen if you walk into someone's house, the first thing that's going to happen is that, like, the kettle gets slammed on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like there's tea or coffee, usually tea. And then there'll be something with that. And then da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, and
yeah.
Whereas, and I mean, I suppose that's kind of like how I would do things. Now, if you're here after mm-hmm. a certain amount of time, I'm going to assume that you're here for dinner. But I would like ordinarily check, are you here for dinner or are we just drinking or like whatever? But then also in London, things are complicated as well because, you know, oftentimes people go out.
Yeah.
Right. Because like we live in really small flats. And so mm-hmm. like, you know, you don't necessarily have a bunch of people around. So there's like a whole thing there as well. But it was interesting to me because it's like on the map, right? For example, there were like, most of the Slavic countries were, I forget what color it was, but it was like, well, maybe they'll give you food. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, it's like you go into like any Slavic house and like one of the first things they'll ask you is, have you eaten? And then even if you say yes, it's just like, bam, like it just starts happening at you. Or like, Germans and their hospitality are so serious about it that, like, I was, shout out to the Muellers, I was living with a German family for, you know, a couple months one summer, and I ended up taking up smoking because it was just, like, among other things, they just, like, keep giving you things. They're just, like, I would wake up every morning, there would just be so much food. They would have made me an entire pot of tea. There was just, like, you know, this entire, and I was just like, what the fuck, man? Like, I can't drink a whole pot of tea. What am I going to do? And then they're just, like, giving you cigarettes after every meal. And it was just, like, and I was like, I can't turn this down. I smoked for a couple months in there because I didn't know how to tell. Like, they were just not taking, I don't smoke for it. Like, that's how much hospitality was happening at me, right? So it's like seeing this is just so weird, and also I'm like, who the fuck made this? And I just feel like an American made it. Is kind of like,
I don't know, but like even if an American made it, like I don't, it wouldn't make any sense to me. Like, I'll be honest, I mean, you know, Americans famously tend to be overweight in many cases, and you know, not eating the healthiest food all the time. But like, I've never been to someone's house in this country where someone was like, no, you're not, you know,
yeah, you're not eating. Like, no, I mean,
you're not eating with us. You know, like, I mean, I never have. Like, I lived in D.C. for a little while. I lived in Denver, lived in the Southeast, you know, like I've yeah. never seen that even once, you know, like, I mean, especially in like the South, you know, whether it's real or feigned or whatever, you know,
yeah.
Southern hospitality, and someone's going to try and like shove like, you know, some ridiculous concoction, you know, down your throat or whatever. Yeah. Like, here's some sweet tea and a biscuit or something with 9 million calories in it, and it's delicious. But you know, yeah, I've never seen it, and you know, I didn't like take it at face value. But I was really weird when I saw it, because I was like, I mean, don't get me wrong, you know, I'm not a huge fan of of England generally, but like, one of the things I, you know, had always been, you know, one of the I guess cultural things that had always been passed down to me is like, yeah, if you go somewhere in England, you're going to get tea, regard, you know, like, if you go to someone's house, they're going to make you tea if it's tea time or whatever.
Completely.
And I mean, like, France, you know, like, the whole thing is, like, if you go somewhere in France, they're just going to fucking shove ridiculously rich food in your, you know, in your face. It's just like, I mean, yeah, I guess, you know, I guess the thing is, to be honest, it's either one of two things. Somebody was just trolling. And if it was just trolling, then, hey, you did it. Good job. Good job, you win. Or it was one of those things where it's like somebody kind of like took some half-assed information and was just like, yeah, whatever, it's fine. We're just gonna, you know.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid. High amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable, it's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals, and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yeah. And I mean, and like, obviously it's half-assed and I shouldn't like let it wind me up or whatever, but I guess the reason why I got wound up about it was that, like, the people started wiling out about history, and I was like, for fuck's sake, you know, and, like, for me, that was a bridge too far.
Yeah, well, the worst part about these things is, like, not, like, the memes and the jokes and stuff, because, I mean, like, yeah, it's funny to be like, you know, what do you get when you show up to a Swedish person's house? It's just a picture of nothing or like an empty tape. Funny. Yeah, yeah. Hey, it's
like, Sara thought it was quite funny. Like, Sara was really like leaning into it and like being like, why don't you simply go buy your own meal deal and bring it over?
McDonald's is down the road. Go.
And like, that was very funny to me. And I liked it a lot, you know.
Yeah, so. But then you get, like, I think the most popular thread was with it was someone who's like, I'm an amateur historian, and let me explain this.
And I mean, I get mad immediately because I'm just like, I'm like, and then it's just like inane bullshit that makes no sense.
Yeah.
Like, Yeah, like, I've got the tweet in front of me. This is blowing people's minds. So as an amateur historian and sociologist, I'm going to try to explain this development cultural fact. So you can't be an amateur sociologist. Fuck you. Like, no.
An amateur sociologist is just someone who has conversations with people.
That's just a guy. Like,
I'm an amateur sociologist. I had a conversation with a guy yesterday. It was great.
I just, like, the entire fucking thing. It was, yeah. And then it was like, basically, then he was all like, oh, there's this strong correlation for Northern Germanic cultures. Which, yeah. I mean, I'm like immediately bristling. Which about like, oh, and then, which is like connected to the honor slash shame economy of the Norse Empire. And I'm like, what the fuck?
What's in no?
So I mean, like, okay, so you could make an argument for the Norse Empire, right?
Yeah.
Because so for example, in like Greenland or Iceland, people would tell you that they were Norse.
Okay,
in the medieval, like like no one called themselves a Viking. Like a Viking is other people's words for them, and also Viking is a job. You know, like it's not like
it's not who I am.
Yeah,
it's
exactly,
just what I do.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and like, basically his thing is like, oh, because like you have to give people hospitality like for Vikings, then like the Protestants like reject this later, which I'm like, no. Like, no. No. Like the idea that like
it's don't get me wrong, I don't like Protestants, but every like everyone I ever met for the beginning of my life down here in the American Southeast is Protestant, and yeah, they didn't have any problem shoving food down my face.
But it's like, so his argument is like, the Protestants are like tamping down on like interpersonal violence. And I'm like, baby, did you think that people were still doing blood feuds in like the 16th century? No.
And what would that have to do? What would that have to do with getting food? It's okay.
Yeah,
it's
so
fine.
And so,
it's fine.
So they're like, oh, so we're not like Vikings, so we're not like, and it's just like, shut up, you know, and like this idea then that like, well, then how do you explain all the Catholic cultures continuing to feed people who are like Italian or whatever? Then like, how do you explain that? Like,
why is Northern Italy in the light blue part? I mean, shouldn't all of Italy be into it? And then like, it should be bleeding into like, especially southern France, where, you know, like the Vendée, you know, Vendée region and all that shit is like, you know, but yeah, I get what, yeah.
Yeah.
What about Ireland? Ireland should be fucking the bluest place on earth if it's down for Catholic, or most of it should be for Catholicism.
Well, and that's the thing that I don't, it doesn't make sense, because all he's attempting to do is kind of like explain the Nordic countries, but the explanation just doesn't cut the mustard, because there isn't actually a rejection of social norms in this particularized way. And more to the point, by the time Protestantism comes in, like the societies as a whole had really kind of moved past feuding.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And it's an interesting one. Like, and it also really kind of like depends as well there, because things in Norway were not the same as things in Iceland, for example. Mm-hmm. So, when you have the consolidation of power underneath the Norwegian throne, there's these interesting things. So it's like, this kind of goes back to our discussion about the Northman. So remember in the Northman, when his uncle gets like pushed off the little island, and then he moves to Iceland. Mm-hmm. So that was really common, that like all the kind of like smaller kings, if they didn't want to submit to the Norwegian crown, which is like a loss of honor or whatever, they went to Iceland. Okay.
Yeah.
And then there is also kind of then a knock on there where some people go to Greenland, some Icelanders go to Greenland, some like Norwegians go to Greenland. And there is still like some kind of like honor violence and stuff going on in Norway at this time. But actually, the one that's like most lawless and wild is Iceland. Iceland, it's just like blood feuds all over the shop. They're just killing each other back and forth all the time. In Greenland, you know, we don't have as much evidence for Greenland as we do for everywhere else, because, you know, it collapsed after 400 years and they didn't bring any of their written stuff with them. So we have to we have to take what we can from like Norway and Iceland.
Yeah.
Talking about them. But in Greenland, we have almost no evidence for them doing interpersonal fighting. And like when there are any feuds, it's like Icelanders or Norwegians who are visiting. because they've got a really small colony, like at its height, yeah. There's like 4,000 people and you just can't go around killing each other.
No, you won't have a society, like, you know, you won't have a society then. Yes. Whatever you want to call a society, you won't have it if you have like 4,000 or 5,000 people and you're just like, oh, time for a blood feud. Gonna wipe out the other clan. There goes 1,000 people. God damn it.
Exactly. And it's like, you do get some murders and stuff back and forth for sure, but it's usually foreigners, as it were. And so you can't even make blanket sweeping statements about like the Norse. Right. Yeah. Like it just doesn't make any sense because like Norway is a lot calmer than Iceland and Greenland is way calmer than all of them. Mm-hmm. And Denmark is pretty fucking calm. Yeah, also.
Denmark is definitely in the red there on the map. And it's like, man, the Danes, like, what did they do?
Yeah. Well, it's like they're kind of they're Scandi, I guess. Like, but, you know, and like it, for a while, like the Norse crown and Danish crown are connected. And then also the thing is fundamentally the Swedes are not the Norse. So like the Swedes have like their own fucking thing going on. So like why are this entire conversation started with Sweden, homeboy?
Yeah.
Why are we talking about like the Norse Empire if we're like, I know, and how, and fucking explain the Finns then also. Because it's like I've got some news for you about Finnish people. Right?
Yeah.
Like they are not actually like
it's the perfidious Rus.
Yeah.
It was all their fault all the time.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't know. So like all of this is wild, right? But like none of it makes sense, but like we can get into some more of it anyway.
Hell yeah. 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 So so moving on from the map just a little.
I'm getting so worked up so early. Oh God.
That's the point. I would get worked up, but I don't think it's physically possible for me yet. So when we talk about like hospitality, like what do we mean here? You know, because like hospitality to us is obviously a bit different. Like because like we said, you know, if you come over to some people's houses, it's very customary to get, you know, here's a snack or, you know, here's a drink or whatever. And then there obviously are some places where it's like you do not get food because that's just not what they do. So, but like, what are we talking about hospitality here in the medieval era?
So, yeah, it's a really interesting one because it's like all medieval things, it's annoying because we have better records for rich people than anything else. Mm-hmm. So we know absolutely tons about like noble and royal hospitality. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this before. So when we've discussed food, had things in the past, there was these huge obligations, especially among like noble and royal households, to feed people if they show up, right? Mm-hmm. And that can bankrupt you. Like that, it's really really serious. If a king shows up at your house, you're basically fucked because you are going to have to just like banquet it up immediately. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also these kind of like ongoing expectations with the nobility, for example. So if you're a noble, you've got your little castle. Christmas, for example, people are just going to show up.
Yeah.
And like, and that is just like on you. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, like, interestingly, there's all these things like, so within English, our word for lord comes from the early English word, which is hlaford. Which is hlaford, and it translates literally as loaf ward, which like someone who guards food.
Hell yeah!
Right, which is so it's like basically just even the concept of a lord means that like this guy owes things like to other fancy people, but also to peasants.
Yeah.
Because within this, there is this kind of expectation, and we might not necessarily think of this as hospitality, but you're supposed to be making sure that peasants are protected and fed, and it's seen as kind of like an exchange for the labor that they do.
So sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. So the manorial obligations here of the manorial lord are considered hospitality to... Okay,
yeah,
that's
like,
very
so
interesting. I didn't think of that.
Yeah, like the two things are kind of connected, right? And it means that sometimes like lords would even like feed commoners and peasants, right? So like and this is something that'll happen more likely at like big holidays like Christmas or Michaelmas, something like that, but it, it's something all right. So these banquets and like, you know, really big hospitality things like this, you like kind of imagine a wedding and you're not wrong. Like, you know, you have like big trestle tables that get set up. And then they're kind of like, you have VIPs up on a big table and then like more and more people that are kind of like further away. Right. And that's like, we still have the term, the high table from this because like you kind of like eat on like a dais, you know, like, and that's where all of like the nobles will sit and they kind of like sit next to each other and everybody looks at them. So they're not like across the table from each other. And then like all your normals will be down kind of like on the floor. And so that might be if a noble is on procession, he's got like his retinue with him, and that's going to include a lot of like commoners. But also it'll be like, I think, so sometimes like on tax days when peasants have to bring like the noble all their money, sometimes there's a feast that they get to go to.
Yeah, you better throw me a feast, motherfucker.
Right? Like that's kind of cool, right? And like it's interesting too because like our word for banquet comes from the old French word that means bench, right? And it's like about like all the benches that you have to bring out to like put to put in front of people. So that's like for fancy people, right? That's for like fancy people. And this is kind of like a distinction you can kind of make sort of like Europe wide, right? But then at a peasant level Europe wide, you do see a lot of kind of like hospitality expectations if someone pops by to visit. And so one of the things that you'll probably get offered is like, you'll probably get offered like bread or beer. And you'll also probably get offered potage. I think I've talked about potage before.
Oh, you definitely have, but my mind is not.
I'm obsessed with, it's like, it is 7 a.m.
It just sounds like potato. It just sounds like you're just getting like potatoes of some kind.
Yeah, it's like a kind of stew that you've always got going on the fire. And so,
That's right.
And it's like, you know, you take all of your scraps and you kind of put it in there. And it usually has like barley or oats in it, but it'll have like scraps of meat. And you're kind of just like constantly feeding the potage. And it really, really whips. I went on the Delicious Legacy podcast sometime last year, shout out to our mates, and it's a great food podcast that you should check out, but he had me around and he made me potage.
Oh, really?
It was really good, man. Like, and you know, he's a real food historian, so he had like all the spice mixes that were kind of like probably
I don't know what I'm imagining here, but just because you said like the barley and oats, I'm imagining like a like an oatmeal.
Yeah, it's kind of like a looser, savory oatmeal. Have you ever had juke or congee, like rice porridges that you get in Japan?
I've had congee.
Yeah, so like, think about like congee, but instead of rice, you're talking about oats or barley.
Yeah, cool.
It's really, really good. So like that's probably always going, and that's something that you would like come out your pockets immediately. You'd be like, hey, here you go. Like that's kind of like your base level, the equivalent of kind of like putting the kettle on.
Before anybody even gets to the door, you see him come and you just walk outside. Yeah, just like, here's your fucking potage. No way.
Right? So
I don't want any.
And that's like a real common kind of peasant form of courtesy. And it's an interesting one too, because like peasant households are pretty big and like inter-village relationships are a particular thing. But there's also within that a kind of expectation that if people are kind of like traveling or something, they like might show up at your house and then you're like, oh, okay, word.
Yeah.
And like you sort of put them up. And like that somewhat has to do with like how dangerous travel can be. But like if someone shows up at your door, a lot of the time you're like, oh, okay, word, like you can stay here for the night. Yeah. And you will see this kind of like in, you know, terrible rapey Chaucer stories and things like that, where it's kind of like, oh, well, you brought your flour to the mill, I guess you can stay here tonight because you're not going to make it back in time. Oh, did you just rape my wife? Ha ha. This is funny. It's Chaucer. Anyway, we do see these things kind of play out where there are these ideas that you kind of like owe people things. And then that also is connected to, for example, monasteries.
Oh, right? Okay.
So monasteries are expected to give hospitality to basically anyone, right?
Really?
Mm-hmm. So
I thought, okay, no, go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, it's a really interesting thing. So it's like, especially if people are on, for example, pilgrimage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, you go basically from monastery to monastery or nunnery to nunnery. And this is also kind of like how hospitals get started. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like the same deal where it's like you can just show up sick at a monastery and they've got to take care of you. So monasteries really kind of like function as inns in a lot of way. And they're a lot of ways. Yeah. And they're kind of like what comes before you have inns proper get kind of set up. And like, even then, even when inns do get set up, like, monasteries are nicer a lot of the time. And so, like, sometimes you'll just have, like, whole retinues of noble people show up at monasteries. And, but as well, like, as peasants. Like, when a peasant is going to go on a journey, they'll be like, okay, well, I'm going to hit up this monastery, and then I'll go to this next one, They will have, like, bunks set aside for whoever's come through. They're going to feed you. And it's like one of these things, you might even get entertainment. Like, they might sing for you, they might do all these things. Now, there are some expectations along with that. Oftentimes you've got to go to mass.
There's always a catch.
Like, exactly, right? Like, but you know, for medieval people, medieval
people like a mass. This is my entertainment for the week.
I hope we get some sermons. Like, you know, but you also get stuff like, you might get given wine or like the really good beer. So that's really exciting. But it's one of these things where, in general, we also, like, part of the reason that we know about this is because, like, in general, when you stay at a monastery, you're kind of like 2 days, two nights, right? Because, like, especially if you're on a long journey, you might be like, okay, I'm going to, like, we're going to get here, and then we're going to stay one more day, and then we'll take off again. But people start kind of abusing it because...
That's awesome.
Because it's like a hotel where, like, they can't kick you out, right?
Be like, no, I'm here. I'm sick.
Yeah, and like, so you see, for example, in England, there's Edward I tries to forbid anyone from, like, staying in religious houses unless you're kind of, like, you'd been invited. This doesn't go down very well. And it doesn't
Longshanks, you bastard.
Yeah, like, it doesn't really... work. Yeah. Let's put it this way, right? And it's like one of these things, like, that's going to be less for peasants and more for rich people.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I
guess that makes sense. And I do vaguely remember, like, you know, them bouncing from, you know, one to, you know, probably from Canterbury Tales or English class or something like that. But it's just so weird to me because, you know, in my mind, you know, monasteries are, you know, like these very cloistered things, you know, like you don't go near, you know, you don't go to a monastery because they're doing the Lord's work, you know, like, and, you know, and so stuff like this is very interesting to me because, like, I really, you know, it really just never occurred to me that people be like, yeah, I gotta go. And they do have to have somewhere to stay. And it's not like the monastery is going to be like, all right, we, you know, going out into the village and being like, all right, you 10 peasants have to keep, you know, these visitors on the trail. That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's really interesting because a lot of monasteries sometimes are even founded specifically to do this. So it's like, there's a Cistercian Abbey, called the Abbey of the Fountains. Mm-hmm. And it was founded in the 13th century specifically as a guest house. And the abbot, John of Kent, said that he was building it to receive Christ's poor as well as the great ones of the world.
It's like, hell yeah, man.
Like, which is really, really cool. Now, within that, though, there's also these expectations. So, like, if you are rich and you show up, there is this kind of expectation that you're going to leave them something.
That's awesome.
You know, it's... And, like, that's up to you. But, like, so there was a lot of... like, so King John in England, it was known to, like, abuse the fuck out of his privilege at monasteries. And, like, so he visited a monastery at Bury St. Edmunds. And, like, he would just stay there for a really long time. And when he leaves the monastery at Bury St. Edmunds, the only present he leaves was a silk scarf and his servants had borrowed it from the Abbey itself.
He regifted them their own scarf.
Yeah, he regifted, and then it was like peace. Like after a while, and like so, it, like it, it's there is, but the point of it is still this hospitality is expected. So it's like, you know, yeah, mm-hmm. you are supposed to give a gift, but there's no recourse, especially if you're mm-hmm. king. If you don't, like it's like, you know, you can go ahead and like give him a check at the end all you want, but there's no real expectation it's going to be paid, and it's just kind of like on your honor. Mm-hmm. About whether or not you're going to do that. Having said that, within monasteries, like one of the things is you probably are separate from where the monks mm-hmm. are. Like, especially originally, you can't go into the cloisters, stuff like that. But they all have like apartments that just kind of like receive people, and that's like a really big and important thing. And this is essentially how you know, pilgrimage is made possible. It's where we get hospitals and things like that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool, right? And like, it's actually just a really neat thing to think about, and it still exists as well. So if you go on El Caminero to Santiago de Compostela in northern Spain, you can still go like from monastery to monastery, like exit monasteries, and they'll put you up.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's just gonna be like a bunk bed. It's like a very hostel style. But it's something that still exists, and I mm-hmm. think that that's really cool. I absolutely love that, right?
Yeah.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Yeah. Now, so I guess one thing before we kind of talk about like private establishments like taverns and inns, I would be remiss without asking about the most famous aspect of this, which is guest right, the concept that, you know, when you go into someone's house, you receive special treatment. You know, you're not going to get ransacked or killed in the middle of the night, you know, after you eat their food or whatever. And this is obviously most famous from Game of Thrones with George Martin's masterstroke of the Red Wedding and all that. You know, so like I'm assuming that they didn't have like entire murders that up in the realm over this, but how seriously did people take the idea of like guest right?
So yeah, like it's a big thing, and we've got especially if what we're talking about is like, again, the Norse world.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, we've got some stuff specifically from a couple of sagas that talk about this. So, Havamal talks about this, and it kind of, like, gives advice, and it's, like, about this, and it's, like, you always have to be generous with guests, and but it also kind of warns you not even to think that, like, you're going to get something in return for it. So, there are stanzas here. So, in stanzas 3 and 4, I've got the quote up. It says, "Fire he needs who with frozen knees has come from the cold without. Food and clothes must the farer have. The man from the mountains come. Water and towels and welcoming speech should he find who comes to the feast." Right? So, it's just basically like, and so we're not even talking about like, oh, you got to feed people. It's like, give them clothes, give them a bath. Like, it's very Hobbit's hot water song kind of deal where they're like, this is really what you need to do. And there's a responsibility further that landowners have to provide amenities and stuff for anyone who's kind of like passing through. So it's like, there's one thing if it's like a feast, right? But it's also just like anybody who goes by. And like, so there is kind of like also approved behavior of guests. So again, Havamal says that if renown he would get and again be greeted wisely and well met, he must act. So it's like you've got to, you know, not act a fool when you're kind of going through these things. And then would-be guests, again, it says, "A forth shall one go, nor stay as a guest in a single spot forever. Love becomes loathing if long one sits by the hearth in another's home." Right? So, like, don't abuse it, right? And this is it within a very particular context within Iceland as well, because Iceland famously quite cold. Don't know if you...
Yeah.
Like,
well, I mean, it is until it moves to the, off the coast of Spain.
And then. Yeah, so... You're in a place which was essentially, and really, wilderness. So it's not like Greenland where the Inuit live there and, like, some Norse guys showed up and were like, hey, we're here now. And the Inuit are like, well, what the fuck is this? Like, it was literally an uninhabited place, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can go long stretches without seeing people in a place that's really quite dangerous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you get caught out, you can just, like, die. So part of this is kind of, like, reinforcing, like, well, you shouldn't let people... die, like, when they're moving around. And again, even within a kind of violent society, there's a sort of expectation that you'll do your best for people, right? Then this kind of, like, extends to, we see in other sagas, so in the tale of Audun of the West Fjords, you get, like, the main character Audun, he kind of, like, goes, he's staying with kings, and, like, for kings it's, like, bigger, right? So he kind of stays, like, with the king of Norway, King Harald. And he wants to hear about, like, because Audun's been around in Greenland, and he's been around, like, in Iceland and stuff like that. And so Harald is like, oh, well, like, I wanna hear about all these things. But there's also this kind of, like, understanding that, like, Audun has, like, is maybe an outlaw, and he's like, okay, well, part of what I'm gonna do is I'm not gonna kill you if you tell me about what's going on, and you can, like, keep all your treasure, which is maybe ill-gotten, and we're gonna let you get down to Denmark. So this is, like, and this is considered, like, as a gift, right? So it's like that he, because he's a guest, he is not going to be, like, tried for anything that he might have done, which is a fun fact, with the Norse Norse trials and stuff, like, they have the big meeting every year, and they are all called various it's various versions of a thing. So in Greenland it's just called the thing, where everybody and, like, everybody just, like, gets together and they, like, you know, have a discussion about, like, whatever anybody's done wrong, right? But, like, so it's like basically out in here is, like, gets told he's not gonna get killed, or we're not gonna, like, do anything like that, but he kind of, like, needs to be like, he has to tell everybody that, like, Harald is a good host, and, like, this is kind of, like, part of it. And, you know, and then it becomes a thing where then the king of Denmark is like, oh, that fucking guy thinks he's generous, I will show you generosity. Right?
And, yeah, I'm gonna fucking you so much shit.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, so there becomes, like, a hospitality off. And and it's like, well, you know, he gives him, like, an arm ring that shows that he's kind of, like, connected to King Svein of Denmark. And it's like, so then, like, everyone should know if you're ever shipwrecked or anything that, like, I will pay you back. So it's like, so you can even have, like, hospitality offs, which I love. I absolutely love that. And then there is also kind of, like, in the Saga of the Confederates, the last one I'm going to bring up here, like, they just talk all the time about people's generosity and hospitality. And it's, like, a judgment of one's character, right? And so, like, we have a character that is called a man of distinction in every respect, but he's not well off financially. And this guy's called Off, like, and so basically he doesn't deny anybody hospitality even though he can't really afford it. So Offig's is seen as popular, as a really popular guy and a really good person, because it's like, it's not necessarily about, like, being able to give the nicest thing. Like, we can't all be a king, right? But the point is going out of your way to be hospitable. And this is something that really recommends you within this society, and something that you can get, like, a, you can get a reputation for. And it, it basically highlights your prestige, and it can bring you up within the society, like, just being generous. And so it might bring you money, like, in, you know, like, the long run, but you're not supposed to see it that way, right?
Yeah.
So it, it is certainly a thing where you're not supposed to, like, slay guests, but it's, like, also, we will see, for example, you know, I said, like, Greenlanders kill each other less. Well, like, times when we see Greenlanders get killed, like, there were some Norwegians over in Greenland, and they were at a feast, and one of the Norwegians gets a little too rowdy, and he kills one of the Greenlander's slaves. And the Greenlanders are like, what the fuck, bro? Like, don't kill my slaves. Like, I don't want you to do that. Like, and then they're like, then they go to the thing. And then there's like, and they're like, yeah, you shouldn't have done that. And so technically a blood feud should happen now. But then the Norwegians just kill like four people and get in a boat and dip. Because it's like, so it's an interesting one, because it's like, you're not supposed to kill your guests. But if a guest kills your slave or whatever, then you can kill the guest.
Oh, then it's on.
Yeah.
Everybody's dying. Yeah.
So it's like, there isn't kind of like a thing where it's like, and obviously you shouldn't go around killing people's slaves or like people. But you never know when like a Norwegian's going to get too drunk and just off and kill someone, I guess. It is kind of like the moral of this story. But the point is that violence can erupt, but there's also like a certain amount of prestige that goes along with that too. Because like, so at the thing, they're like, yeah, this Norwegian's done fucked up. But the Norwegians are like, yeah, well, what are you going to do? Bah, bah. And it's like, also like, if you are from like the highest Greenland family, technically you can get everybody together with you and be like, we're going to kill these Norwegians now. But if everyone's like, I don't know, dude, like what if, like, what if the king sends a bunch of guys, they can be like, no. Right, and then they're like, oh well, fuck, right? So there's kind of like these varying relationships there. So it's not as easy as kind of like saying, oh well, like society is feudal and it's super hierarchical and you know, it will bring you dishonor and all these things, because it's like, well, it does, isn't it? Doesn't. And like, in the ways of kind of like seeing what a guest is and what your responsibilities are to them really, really depends on who we're talking about, right?
Yeah, it does. And yeah, just I think that's pretty interesting. And there's also the concept of like bread and salt, which is an Eastern and Central European and Arab thing as well, where people are given you know, a little pinch of bread and a pinch of salt as when they enter a home, as you know, a sign of respect and tradition and stuff like that. And I just think it's very interesting because it's still such a widespread thing, especially in like Europe and especially in Russia and Eastern Europe, that they even do it on the International Space
Station. They do. And I love it. Like, this is one of these like very fun like Slav things where we like we came up with this. You're welcome, everybody. And like our neighbor
love bread,
and our neighbors like it, and so it's like a thing that everyone like. So for example, Germans will do the kind of bread and salt thing, and it kind of like shows the sort of like long-lasting alliance between spouses' families. You will see it in the Balkans. Like our good friends there will do the same kind of things. The Romanians do it. And the Romanians like will do this as just like a generalized welcoming sort of thing. You definitely see it kind of like in like Russia, Belarus, and the Ukraine. And like that there, they go like whole loaf of bread. They're like, here's your loaf of bread. And like you put it, you have a special cloth, which is called a rushnik, that you put it down. And then you put like, and a lot of time you also like bake the loaf specifically so it'll hold a salt cellar. That's on top of it, which I think is really, really, really cute. And like you even saying like a kleb dasol, like a bread and salt, like as a way of saying hello.
That's awesome.
In Russian, awesome. Which I dig. And like, as, you know, you basically see this all over. So for us, for like Slovaks and Czechs, basically, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, a standard greeting. Yeah. And like a lot of the time, especially if you go into a Czech or Slovak person's house, especially if you are in the countryside, like the thing that's going to happen is you're going to get given beer and they'll put out bread and salt and like butter. And it's like, you know, like you're not going to use the salt, but it just kind of goes with the territory. Like
it's
Yeah. And like that, and that's going to be like course one. Like that's the thing. So it's like, you usually start with that. And then pretty much the longer you sit there, the more food starts coming out. I can say that about it. Right. Yeah. Then like the Finns and like, you know, the Latvians, Lithuanians and stuff like that, they often do it for like, as a symbol of like blessing new houses. And that's usually like the dark rye bread and stuff like that. Now, there's a thing within this where some people have said, like Finns have said, like, yeah, we do the dark rye bread so people won't actually eat it. which I think is stupid because I love dark rye bread. So I'm like, well, it wouldn't work, on me, motherfucker. Like, guess what? But and you definitely see this in Arab culture as well. Like Arabic culture, it's like there more specifically within Arabic culture, it's more of an expression of alliance. And less of welcome, if you see the difference.
Yeah.
And so basically, like, if you're having like bread and salt with a friend, you're saying that now you're creating a moral obligation, like eating this, right? But it's less so for Slavs, and we're just a bit more like, well, I'm not a fucking monster.
Yeah.
Like this is just like welcoming, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Like, and that's just how it be, right? Yeah. So it's a really potent symbol. And, you know, salt is kind of included here, especially because salt is a little bit of a luxury good in the medieval periods. And it's like, yeah, I would even give you salt. You like that? Like, that's how welcoming I am. Like, oh, buddy. And, like, bread is sort of expected because if you've been traveling, if you've been coming a long way, you know, let's face it, the majority of people who are going anywhere in the medieval period are walking. And you're just like, well, here's what's up. Like, you've got to feed these people. And bread is kind of like one step up from potage, right? So, like, there's a kind of, like, saying that what it's saying is that, like, you are respected by this person and you're going to hook them up, right?
Yeah. And, so that brings us to the last bit here, and that's... hospitality with regard to like taverns and inns, private establishments, because you know, this is actually whether we realize it or not, one of the few places where something like guest right or hospitality has been like formalized. Because, you know, if you go stay in a hotel, even in America, most places have, you know, laws where you have a duty to protect these people, you know, and the people who are staying within your thing. So, like, how is that in medieval times? Like, how is that?
So, like, inns kind of come up later. We have, like, our best records for inns and things kind of start, like, you know, especially in England, they start to come up more often in the 14th century. And they are a business venture.
Yeah.
Right? So what they're kind of doing is sort of formalizing what monasteries are doing. But it's, like, it's formalized, so it's like, no, you are going to pay for this, right? And inns kind of cropping up sort of latches on with stuff like, you know, the real rises, for example, of the guilds, right? So this is kind of a part of the medieval period when people are really starting to specialize in business, and like innkeepers are the same. So innkeepers are very much kind of like a part of the elite, right? Like you can make a lot of money on of this. And so if we're talking about an English inn, what that's going to usually have is a hall. For eating. You're going to have a kitchen where they make all the things. There's going to be a stable for keeping people's horses and like storage chambers and stuff like that for, you know, where the innkeeper stays and things like that. And often there is then going to be chambers for sleeping. And you're going to have a range here. So there's going to be, the most common thing you're going to have is basically like a bunch of bunk beds, like a communal sleeping chamber where people can sleep. But if you are especially fancy in, or you're trying to cater to like, you know, rich people, then you'll have kind of like private rooms with locks. And that becomes more prevalent over the period as well. So by the time you hit the early modern period, it's more likely that you're going to have lots of modern rooms there. So it's interesting too, because inns also do, you know, it's typical medieval stuff. They often also do something else as well. So often they make their own beer or they make their own wine. Some of them are also centers for cloth production. And things like that. So they are really, really common in, especially from the 14th century onwards. And most provincial capitals are going to have at least like 10 inns. Because if people are coming to market and stuff, they're going to want somewhere to sleep. Right. Yeah. And this is a big boon as well, because monasteries and things like that are often in the countryside. They're not in towns. And you might have monasteries that are in towns. So especially if you are like one of the mendicant orders, like if you're a Franciscan or a Dominican, they're more likely to be in towns. Mm-hmm. But towns, especially in this period, because they're really expanding, you've got a lot more commerce, you've got a lot more people who are coming and going. There's no way that the monasteries can really see to everyone who's coming into town. So that starts the inn as kind of a business venture. And the thing is, you will get good hospitality there, but it is a business venture, right? You're not going to get away with, like, borrowing a scarf from someone and giving it back to them, right? So we see, like, really heavy rents that kind of, like, go through this. And, like, basically, you kind of, like, get... You do get yearly revenue, but, like, the yearly revenue is oftentimes lower than you would think. So, hilariously, Winchester College... which is still a very fancy private boys' school, they have an inn in Andover. And from 1366 to 1404, they spent about £400 keeping the inn up. It's called the Angel Inn. And the yearly revenue they wanted to get on this is 10 quid. So, like, granted, it's over kind of like a, you know, 40-year period. But it kind of like they're just about breaking even, right? And they didn't really quite make it. It was sort of like you might get anywhere from 7 quid to 10 quid. So it is possible to make money, but not guaranteed, which is why innkeepers a lot of times have a kind of diverse sort of set of things that they're doing. So it's like, well, you might make more money if you're also like brewing and selling beer, for example. But innkeepers, especially if you're good at it, you often kind of like become part of a city's elite. A lot of the time they're involved in local governments. A lot of times they act as like bankers, which will be a thing. Cause so it's like they, you know, because they've got a lot of room, people come from all over. So it's like, you can deposit money with them or trade things. And basically by the end of the medieval period, to be considered like a fancy or important town or city, you have to have inns in order to even be considered like a good city, right? And inns are a pretty substantial investment, and you've got to kind of like have a look at them. But they are doing a business here. So it is, this is when we start seeing hospitality as a form of commerce. And so it's kind of a late medieval invention within this. And it speaks to greater commerce, more travel, and how the population is kind of moving around at the time.
I think that's about going to wrap us up for hospitality here, because that's a lot of info.
Sorry everybody
why would you apologize? That is very good. I asked you the question. thank you so much and it's fun to do this, you know, to be able to talk about it, you know, using some stupid shit from Twitter as the springboard to it. But we thought it'd be a good episode to do, and hope you enjoy it. And I think that's going to about wrap us up for today. But Eleanor, before we go, can you tell the people where to find your work?
You can check out my blog, going-medieval.com. You can find me on Twitter at goingmedieval. And you can check out my comic book, The Middle Ages, A Graphic History, please. And thank you. I would enjoy that.
I'm Luke, at Luke is Amazing on Twitter. You can find my Star Wars podcast, People's History of the Old Republic, wherever you're listening to this. And that's about it for me. So in the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next time.
Bye.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.